Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and Century Wealth Management.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Pearson Crutcher.
And I'm Jay Healy. Pearson runs the Society of Entrepreneurs. It's a membership organization founded to promote Memphis entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to business owners.
Jay Healy is the founder and president of Century Wealth Management, an entrepreneurial firm that can serve as your family's CFO. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights.
Welcome to our conversation with Craig Brewer. Craig is Memphis-based, but has achieved remarkable success in the film industry as a director, a producer, and a screenwriter. Some of the films he's well known for include Hustle and Flow from the early 2000s, Black Snake Moan from 2005, a remake of Footloose in 2011, and the pending release of Coming to America, a sequel with Eddie Murphy, which comes out in March of 2021. Craig started as an independent filmmaker here in Memphis because that was his passion, and it's very interesting to hear the journey of how he got to the level of success that he has. He'll also share some thoughts on how directing a film is like building a business, what the future of the film industry looks like, and why Memphis is so important to him. I will say that this podcast was recorded as a live online event, so the audio quality may be different than our other podcasts, but everything should be fine. Please enjoy our conversation with Craig Brewer.
Pearson Crutcher. I am the Executive Director of the Society of Entrepreneurs. We are a membership organization of local entrepreneurs. Our mission is to educate and encourage entrepreneurs, so we do that by our monthly roundtable meetings. And at the roundtable meetings, which are sponsored by Paragon Bank Behind the Scenes and eBiz Solutions, so we really appreciate those people for making these possible. We love to talk to seasoned entrepreneurs and have them answer questions about their journey. So Jay Healy is with me today. Jay is the CEO of Century Wealth Management. And Jay and I have a unique partnership. We're working together on our podcast, Entrepreneurial Insights, which we dropped the first one. You like that jargon? Okay, now know the podcast. We dropped the episode yesterday with Dick Gadomski. So we've been having a great time, so I've asked Jay to be our special guest to talk about his business shortly, Jay, before we get the program started with Craig. So, Jay, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Sure. Thanks, Pearson. So the podcast has been fun. I really encourage anybody who's interested in some of the conversations to check it out and certainly give us feedback and ratings if you want to. And, Pearson, I appreciate the invitation to today's event. Just as a simple explanation of Century Wealth Management, what we do, who we work with. So we were a firm founded in 2000, really to serve my father-in-law, who is Dick Gadomski, a member of the Society of Entrepreneurs, after he sold his business. And so for the first several years, I worked pretty much exclusively for him, but then built a platform where I could serve other people along the way, and in the mid-2000s opened up to take outside clients. One of the things that I think is unique about what we do and how we do it, we work with a lot of entrepreneurs. And when you are building and growing a business, you are building capacity inside that business to manage your personal affairs. So you may have a CFO who gives you tax advice. You may have a personal assistant who helps you do the administrative work. And when you exit your business, sometimes those resources disappear. Well, we have built those resources in our business so that people can easily and effectively migrate from doing that at work to having it be done for you personally. So we consider ourselves a family CFO. And with that, we manage investments and do financial planning and all the administrative work that needs to be done behind the scenes. That's my elevator speech for Century Wealth Management.
Well, very good and very timely. Thank you very much. He knew I was going to cut him off. I've got the power of the mute button over here. But Jay also, we will give a door prize at the end of the session, and Jay is sponsoring that. We are giving Monkey is King, I don't know if you've seen this book, but it's by John Malmo. It's fabulous. He used to write an article for the Commercial Appeal, and it is a collection of his great articles. So that will be, I will announce who the recipient of that is at the end of this meeting. Well, I am very excited to get this program started with Craig Brewer today. Craig, thank you. I know that right now your life is a little crazy, since March the 5th will be the coming out of Coming to America. So I hope that you will discuss some of that. That's really exciting. When I was preparing for this meeting, though, I did rewatch your video. And one of the things that struck me was the initial conversation of, what is your spine? So, Craig, I think that in your words, why don't you tell us a little bit about what your spine is, where you came from, and what that means?
I forgot we talked about that. Hello, everybody. I grew up in the theater. I grew up acting. And there's all these tricks that actors have to kind of learn to get in touch with their character and keep the narrative moving forward. And especially when you're dealing with film, what a lot of people don't realize is that you're filming out of continuity. So if you have a location or something where the first scene in the movie and the last scene in the movie happens to be at this location, then you're filming the first part and the last part maybe on your first day of filming. You have to kind of know your character in all different places as to where they are. So I'll give you an example of what I mean by find your spine. So Tootsie, I don't know if y'all remember Tootsie with Dustin Hoffman. Sidney Pollack, who directed the film, was talking about that he as a director needed to find a spine for Tootsie. And because he was smart and he realized that once you see Dustin Hoffman in the dress, you got like about 5 minutes or 10 minutes of funny, but then it's going to wear off and you're going to get a little lost as to where the story's going. So he basically created, I mean, you could call it a spine, you could call it a mantra, you can call it whatever you want to, but he basically came to the notion that the movie is about Dustin Hoffman becoming a better man by becoming a woman. So if he faces a scene that's later in the movie or in the middle or wherever, or an idea comes up, he would say, oh, that's a good idea, but does Dustin Hoffman's character become a better man by being a woman in this idea? And that would be the core of his intent with the movie, and all decisions would fall in line with that. I mean, I'm reading a lot, I'm sure like everybody else during the pandemic, you're reading a lot of, not necessarily self-help books, but Atomic Habits and all these different kinds of new ways of living your life. And sometimes I'll talk about like swimming teams or like people that weren't like winning at something. And they basically decided like, well, can I ask a question that would override every decision? In other words, like, oh, I think I'm going to go out for drinking tonight. Well, is that going to make the boat go faster when we're in competition? Oh, well, no, it won't make the boat go faster. I should probably go home and go to bed, or I should go work out. Then the spine or the line in your head is dictating all of your decisions for better productivity and so forth. So that's just something that from directing and acting and things when I was younger are helpful when you're starting something. And so when I grew up in the theater, you would learn all these things. And then I found that when I started making movies, it would help. It would help a lot with actors looking to you for leadership. And many times I'm trying to find what I call the note under the note. If somebody's saying, like, being very specific with like, well, this is a problem, this is a problem, this is a problem, I'd be like, okay, there's probably some larger problem that they're not able to articulate. And I've got to figure out what the large note is over these particulars. I'll give you an example. Hate to ramble, but I was on set once with a writer and an actor that was in a TV show. We were doing a television pilot. And all the actor had to do was, in one scene, he was in one outfit. And now in this scene, he's changed into a different outfit. Seems simple. And so I come up to the actor and I say, like, okay, so just as this scene begins, I'm going to start on your shirt. I'm going to come up to you. You're going to be putting on the shirt and buttoning it up. He goes, I would be dressed by now, Craig. That doesn't make sense. I turn to the writer who wrote the episode and he goes, no, no, we need to show that you're changing because it's part of your character. You're this thing out in the world, but then you go into your garage and you change into this thing and you come into this thing. And the actor was just absolutely adamant that the scene should already begin with him dressed in the other outfit. And it turned into kind of a fight. And the actor stormed off and went to his trailer. And my job is to go to the trailer and make it all happen and make sure we make our day. And I met with the actor and I met with the writer. And I was like, so is this going to be the one argument that we have over a shirt? I was kind of hoping it'd be over something else. And he goes, I don't know, Craig. I don't know. And I was like, you know what? We're going to figure this out. How about you just be buttoning up the shirt as the scene begins? And he goes, that works. And I left the trailer and I was like, I didn't do my job. And the writer was like, what are you talking about? I go, I didn't see the note under the note. I didn't see really what he was worried about. He's like, well, what is he worried about? That was just ridiculous. And I was like, oh yeah, here, take your shirt off real quick, sir. He's like, what? I go, that's a good looking guy. I was like, just take your shirt off. He goes, in front of the crew? And I go, that's his problem. That's his problem. It has nothing to do with the character, has nothing to do with the art. And it's like, I should have seen that maybe he's gained a little bit of weight since the last show he was in or something like that. I should have seen what the basic theme of like the particular problems that he has. And that kind of plays into the larger thing. Sometimes a lot of my job is going like, it's this. And that, I think, is what the whole spine thing has helped me with. It's a very rambling answer to tell you about the spine.
I think it's good. And I think it actually answers a lot of the question of how a director is a member of the Society of Entrepreneurs, because I think it all ties into that you're keeping the main thing, and figuring out the best way to do it. So I think it makes perfect and complete sense. Also, one of the things that you said did bring me back to, I want to talk about the fact that you do have your roots in Memphis. This is where you're from. This is where you grew up. Can you go back a little bit and let's start from the beginning and how you got your roots and how you knew this is what you wanted to do?
Well, I didn't specifically grow up here or at all grow up here, but I am from here. My mom, her side of the family is from Rossville, or more so Fisherville. My granddaddy, her dad, was a famous baseball player, Marvelous Marvin Throneberry. And later in life, he became a celebrity on the light beer commercials that they would argue whether it tastes great, less filling.
Cool.
Marv would be at the end of the commercial looking at the camera going, I still know why they asked me to do this commercial. Light beer from Miller. Everything. So it was interesting that my family was very much into sports, but I was a chubby kid when I was young. And so I got into theater. But ultimately, I signed with the same agency that my granddaddy had as an entertainer. So both me and my granddad both shed sports and went into entertaining people. My dad's side of the family is all from Collierville. I don't know if anybody remembers buying Russ Dunn eggs. That's like one of the part of our family that had an egg farm in Collierville or Piperton area. But then my mom and dad got married. My dad joined the Army. So I was born in Virginia at Fort Eustis on an Army base. And then we would move around. My mom and dad were basically like the only ones within their family that kind of, I don't want to say got out, like it was a Tennessee is the Titanic or something like that. But they were just moving around with a lot of different jobs. But every summer, every Christmas, we were always going home, and that was Memphis. But I grew up a lot of my life in Northern California when my dad was there with his job, and a little bit in Southern California. And it wasn't until really I graduated high school and started producing some plays that I wanted to actually, both my grandfathers passed away. And so I decided I wanted to come and just live in the small house that my dad grew up with in Collierville. And that's really where my career got started. I started just making movies on the streets of Memphis, and I started learning everything I could about Memphis. I've always been fascinated with Memphis throughout my teenage years, because I'd come home for the holidays and my Aunt Mary Jean would take me down to Beale Street and we'd buy a bunch of blues records and everything. I would always come back to high school, and while everybody was wearing like Duran Duran and Wham and Skritti Politti t-shirts, I had like Howlin' Wolf, and that was my way of being a rebel. it was to kind of embrace blues and soul. But it really was like 1993, 94 that I moved here, and I've been here ever since.
Did you always want to be a film producer, a film director?
Yeah, I remember what it was. It's really interesting you say that, because I've been asked that a lot, and I've tried to like pinpoint the moment that I realized I wanted to be a filmmaker. And I think I finally figured it out, which was when I was in the fourth grade, I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now, when I was younger, I'd see Star Wars and all different kinds of movies. But I think up until then, I believed that movies were kind of like, I didn't think about them being made. they were just that thing that you'd go to and you get to eat candy and popcorn and have a great time in the dark watching some great story. And then you got to play with toys afterwards, that you got to make the movie again with your Lando Calrissian and stormtroopers. But then I was like, oh, I'm going to be an archaeologist. I'm going to find the Ark of the Covenant. I'm going to be Indiana Jones. That's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be hopping from truck to truck and kissing pretty girls like Miriam. And that's the life of an archaeologist. And then I saw a movie that my dad rented. This is back, I'm 49, and I'm sure there's others probably listening that are my age, but there was a time where you had a video store, and this is pre-Blockbuster. The video store was usually part of like a TV appliance store, and they started renting movies. And so my dad was kind of going through a renaissance of watching movies like Bridge on the River Kwai and all the old movies. So it was kind of like a film festival in my household back in the day. But one thing that he brought home was there was a new video cassette called The Making of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then I was like, who's this skinny guy with the hat walking around telling everybody what to do? Like, that may be what I want to do. You know, I don't know if I want to be Indiana Jones. I think I want to be Steven Spielberg. And so it became this thing that my dad and I would do. He would be like, oh, well, he did Jaws. And I was like, well, I don't think I've seen Jaws. And so we'd watch Jaws. And then like when E.T. came out, I remember specifically my dad and I going to the theater knowing it was the new movie from Steven Spielberg. So we were director driven at that time. And it's interesting because I just did Coming to America. And one thing that I've been talking about a lot is how much I loved the films of John Landis when I was growing up. And it also was because of a making of movie. When Michael Jackson's Thriller came out, this movie came out on MTV that then came out on VHS called The Making of Thriller. And John Landis directed Thriller, but during the making of Thriller, him and Michael Jackson are talking about American Werewolf in London. They're talking about Kentucky Fried Movie, which is a very obscure movie that I wouldn't recommend to everyone, but I thought it was a revelation in my life personally. And then we started watching John Landis movies. And my dad, I'll never forget this, put in the Blues Brothers one night and my life changed. I was like, wait, is that James Brown? I've been hearing James Brown, but is that James Brown? Is that Aretha Franklin? And then like it started growing. It's like, yeah, that's Duck Dunn. He was in Booker T. and the MGs. That's Steve Cropper. He's the guitar player from Booker T. and the MGs. These are Memphis people. So it started to kind of like feel like there was an education that was happening with the video rental culture with me. And that's kind of how I started getting interested in becoming a filmmaker.
Your first film was Poor and the Hungry, right?
Well, no, I talk about this. My first film was a movie that I made called Melodies Surviving, and I shot it on film, and it was an absolute disaster. I maxed out my credit cards. I think I blew like 30 grand of credit card debt on it, and it was just an absolute nightmare. I think I just like about 4 years ago, I recently got the rest of it developed, but I learned a really big lesson on it. The lesson I learned was that it's actually a good business lesson, which was that I thought that you could make a duck just by walking and quacking like a duck. And so I was like, well, movies are made on film. So I got to pay for this camera to do it on film. And I got to have this kind of a tripod to hold that kind of heavy of a camera. I've got to like, oh, wait a minute. I need a dolly. I need to do all these things. And then I'd get the film back and I'd be like, yeah, but the scene isn't that alive. The scene isn't all that good. And it's because I put all this energy into all the dressings, all the things that everybody said you should have in a movie. And I hadn't really thought about the story. I hadn't really thought about the performances that were happening because I was so specifically like dealing with all these other smaller things that people said, well, that's how it's done. And it wasn't until later that my dad read this movie that I wrote called The Poor and Hungry, which was about car thieves in Memphis. And it took place at the P&H Cafe and on Madison and had a lot of colorful people in it. And my dad called me up and said, you're going to mess up this movie, I worry. And I was like, why do you say that? And he goes, well, I think you're going to overproduce it. It's about people that don't have any money. And I think that you need to just get one of those little video cameras and try to make the movie feel like what the subject is. So they don't have any money. You don't have any money. Celebrate the fact that you don't have any money and make it in black and white. And so I did. It was me and my brother-in-law. He held the microphone. I held the camera. We lit it with clamp lights and photo flood bulbs. And we made our own lights. And I had an 83 Honda Civic that my dad drove, and then I drove in high school, and then my sister drove in high school, and then I got it back when she went to UT, and we took out the back seat and laid down plywood. And so, like, everything fit in an 83 Honda Civic. And that's how we made the movie. And it's interesting because I made it with $20,000 that I got from my father passing away. The day he told me you should just do it on a video camera, he actually died of a heart attack. My dad died of a heart attack at age 49, and we weren't expecting it at all. He was a healthy guy. And I just turned 49 this last December. So it's nothing like going into your career and going into the back end part of your life with some good mortality issues. But it's been good for me to approach this year with everything that I've been able to do with it.
So if we looked at your resume, we would see The Poor and the Hungry, and we would see Hustle and Flow and all the other movies you made over time. What that doesn't tell you is how hard this journey is. I would imagine that every movie is like starting a business. So could you give us some background of like how hard that journey was? And
it's kind of like two questions, because it's like there's the question of what's hard about making a movie, and then like what's hard to like start a career in movies. And the question I usually always get is like, how do you make it? How do you make it in the movie business? And there's so many different ways to do it. But I think that, well, it's interesting. Here I go tangentially again. So I sang in choir when I was in high school. And I remember my choir teacher, Ted Reed, he told me something that resonated with me. And that was like, okay, so I don't know if anybody reads music, but let's say that you see notes going up to a really high note and then it starts coming down. You think to yourself like, oh, that high note is going to be a problem for me. I don't know if I can go that high. He said, don't think about the high note. Think about the note after the high note. Focus everything you can on this note after the high note when you start coming down, the note that you know you can hit. I think about that a lot when I think about like how hard it is to make a movie or to keep going in this career, is that a lot of people wonder like, well, how do I get into it? And I was like, I think the more you start working at it, the more you go, I know I used to think that that was the high note, but the more worrisome note is, what do you do once the door opens and you can start doing it? And no one really puts that much concentration on what they would do once the door opens. And I sometimes will have people say like, well, how do I make films? And I go, well, tell you what, in a minute, tell me about the movie you want to do. And then they tell me the movie. Usually takes them longer than a minute. And I go, oh, I said just a minute. So, okay, that's good. We're not interested in that. What else do you have? Like, well, there's a movie like this. And it's like, we have something like that in development. What else do you have? And then you start realizing like, oh, I'm not ready for this moment. I'm not ready to say to them who I am, because it takes so long to make movies. And it kind of gets back to that spine thing. It's like, why are you making this movie? Why should you make the movie? Why should we let you make the movie? And what's that singular thing that you're trying to tell? I remember when Paramount called me up and they wanted me to make the remake to Footloose, and I turned them down. I was like, absolutely not. Absolutely no way am I going to do a remake of Footloose. I loved the movie, the original movie. And I go, and it's stupid. Nobody's going to, there's not a town that bans dancing. It's just ridiculous. But I was a dad now. When I saw Footloose when I was younger, it was, I wanted to be Kevin Bacon, spinning and dancing. But now I'm a dad, and I kind of don't care about their personal freedom. I want them safe. I know that sounds, that's not completely true, but you can probably understand. Like, I don't care if you think that you're getting to be independent. You need to call me at 11 o'clock and tell me where you are, and then you need to come out. It's like you become your parents. And so I was like, well, that makes sense. Maybe that's, I need to personally connect. And so it's like, I realized that in Footloose, the movie, they talked about this crash that happened, these four teenagers that died in a car crash. And I was like, well, we've never seen that in Footloose. What if we start the movie with these teenagers drinking and dancing and have a good time? And then they get in this huge wreck. And then now the town is traumatized because basically the four children of like the four biggest families in this small town, they had this unauthorized party, and then they went out and they drank and they got in this car accident. And then they started passing laws to make it so young people can't congregate without anybody else. And it's like, then it's like, I figured out how to do it in 2011. It's like, oh, well, America and humans do overreact for safety concerns. and youth is meant to challenge us on where we overdo it. And that's a theme that's never going to go away. And so once I found that's fine, once I found that way, it's like everything else suddenly came and fell into place. And I think that so many times in a business or in any sort of venture, you're flooded with all these like tiny details that are coming at you. And you've got to have like that one thing that you're trying to tell.
That's true. One thing I want to say real quick is that if anybody does have any questions, if they put it in the chat, then we can ask Craig as we go along. And I meant to say that before. But I do have a question, Craig, that do you have any mentors? I know your father was certainly a mentor, but I know you had other mentors along the way. Is there anybody that's been really helpful in guiding you as you've gone through the business?
Well, definitely my dad. And then I was really fortunate to have John Singleton, a filmmaker who did Boys in the Hood and numerous other Poetic Justice and Higher Learning. He was the first one that showed me how to deal with Hollywood as a business and how to like manage a set with a bunch of people working for me, because up until then I did everything myself. And so I would say that where my dad taught me to like, it's funny because I was talking about this last night that I get defensive. I shouldn't, but I get defensive that I didn't go to college. And so I would have loved to have gone to college. I don't poo-poo anybody that's gone to college, but I didn't go to college and I didn't go to film school, but I did work at Barnes & Noble and I had a good 35% discount. And so I'm a big believer in like being an autodidact. You're buying the books, you're watching the commentary tracks, you're going on YouTube and learning everything you can. Because I think that there's a mentality with education that like, well, if I just get that grade or if I get that degree, that somehow a door is going to be open for me. And my dad, I think, was the first one that really kind of instilled that in me, was like, you got to learn it. You've got to learn it. There's not some school. And even if there are schools that can inform me about those kind of things, it's like, you've got to have the desire and the drive to kind of be on that tightrope without a net. It was Singleton really that said, okay, that fuel in your rocket got you here, but now you're in the real business. And that means delegation. That means you may be shutting up a little bit and asking questions and listening. That means having patience to know when to make moves and not to just go and make a move. Even on this last movie, it was really difficult to edit Coming to America, like we're talking right now. We would edit on Zoom, essentially. Usually I'm in the room with my editor. The one downside to having Zoom is now people can watch. You don't have that intimate thing with your editor cutting your movie together, and then you show it to people. And then so now they're getting the producers and the studio execs to get a lot more persnickety because they're with you the whole time. They're watching you, and it's not really personal. And there would be times that they would want to try things, and I would disagree with it. I could hear almost like John Singleton in my head going like, hey man, just let him try it. Let him try it and let it die on the vine if it doesn't work. You got another month of this, change it back. When I was younger, it's like, no! I was very combative. Now it's like, I want to embrace a little bit more of being like an old head going like, okay, go ahead. And then coming back like the next morning going like, well, that didn't really work, did it? Okay, we're going to change it back. And I'm going to take some of the ideas that I got from your suggestion. Thank you. And we'll try it this way. So now they feel
heard.
Felt bad because their idea didn't work. But I also could leave them with their dignity a little bit. And I think that's what John taught me, was to be a little bit more patient with the process.
Well, that's a true art. I'm sorry, Jay.
No, I just said that's an important lesson. So out of curiosity, how long does it take to make a film from start to finish?
It's interesting because right now I'm in a very difficult position that, I mean, it's a fortunate position, don't get me wrong, is that I'm now in a position that I could probably, with the right ingredients, get a movie going. So I'm, for the first time in my career, I have like four projects that I'm moving down the field, and one of them will go. But I've got to put energy into all four of these ideas and projects and simultaneous. So what usually happens is that, like, let's say I have an idea. So this is kind of a we can do it within a year and it'll work perfect for this one project that I'm doing right now. So I came up with an idea in December of, actually, that's not true. I came up with this idea and I pitched it to Universal Studios, and I think it was probably September of last year. So I pitched them the idea. They liked the idea. They said, we want you to write the idea. Then 3 to 4 months of legal deals happening to ensure that should the idea move forward, that they're going to do it. So lawyers are a big part of the entertainment industry. So basically, I got commenced. So that's a big word in the industry. I got commenced to write the project on Christmas. It means like a check. And so that's when I start. And so usually it takes me about 3 months to develop a script. So I write it, I get notes, I do rewrites. Sometimes I give it to a line producer to budget it. And they're like, Craig, you've got like 9 crowd scenes in here and it's a period movie or whatever. And that's a lot of extras. And we got to feed the extras. We got to dress the extras. We got to put hair on them of the time period. Like, can you do 2 crowd scenes? And so it's like, sometimes budget comes in and I got to like, okay, let me see if I can redo this. Oh, tell you what, we'll have the 2 characters sitting at a bar and they're watching a feed on television of it. And we can, and they're like, oh, that's cheaper to do. So it's like, you're in that mix for about 3 months. Then let's say that you have all the elements, you get an actor involved. Let's say you spend a month going out to actors or actresses saying that they will or will not do it. So let's just say that I started writing January, February, March, which means April, I'm going out to the community to try to cast it. So let's say that I have a go picture. That means that May, I'm in prep. So you want to do about 2 to 3 months of prep, but let's just say it's usually 10 weeks, but let's just give it the buffer of casting. So it's another 3 months. So January, February, March to write it, April to cast it, May, June, July, you're preparing for it. July, August, September, October, I'm filming it. Then it's a 5-month editorial process. Wow. So that's, what are we at? November, December, and then of the next year, January, February, March. It's a year out of your life and more. Then you're in what I'm in now, which is 2 to 3 months of selling your movie. And so you're then doing a bunch of marketing and ads on your movie after that. It's a long process and you learn a lot, but it's rewarding. But then again, like, when you're sitting down and deciding which projects you want to go on, it's like, what do I want to spend a year of my life on? This means time away from my kids. It means a lot of stress. And it's not always monetary. It's not like, well, this one is going to pay me the most. Because usually the ones that pay you more, there's a reason they're paying you more. it's a damn hassle.
What's the peak number of them, of people working on a movie?
Oh, a couple hundred.
Wow. Yeah. I know we're kind of short on time, and I want to ask a lot of questions. I'm going to ask you a lot of rapid-fire questions.
I'll try to stop being so long-winded.
No, that's okay. I love it. I don't want you to stop. But how did you learn the craft of screenwriting? How did you learn that? Somebody asked
I, of course, bought a lot of books, and then I came up with a system that really works for me where I use these note cards. Basically, every screenplay is about 120 pages long, and in screenplay language, every screenplay page equals 1 minute of screen time. So that means that your script is not only 120 pages or less, but it's 120 minutes or less, which means 2 hours or less. So what I usually do before I start every movie is I study 4 other movies that are comparable in tone and in storytelling, or just themes that I want to study. I will study them by watching the movie, and I take notes as to what happens every 10 minutes, and I keep the counter on, you know, how like when you hit info on your Blu-ray or whatever, and you can see like how many minutes in. So sometimes I'll watch a movie and be like, okay, here's Close Encounters. Richard Dreyfuss just saw the aliens, just hit him with a light. That was at 22 minutes into the movie. Okay, so what's my 22 minute thing in my movie? What's my character seeing the light, or his version of that? And so it'll sometimes inform me with ideas. I remember when I was writing Tarzan, one of the movies I was studying was Apocalypto. And there was this moment in Apocalypto where an old man was telling a campfire story to a bunch of people. And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And I was like, what would be my version of that? And I was like, oh, Tarzan and Jane should come back to their old village and they should be telling the legend of Tarzan as if like it's a campfire story. But then you're seeing Tarzan's thoughts about what really happened that day. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. So it's, I wouldn't call it theft, but that's kind of what storytelling is you're taking old stories and you're reinterpreting it. And that's how I ultimately, I mean, you can get a book on screenwriting and it's very, there's programs that'll show you how to do it. That's the easy part. The hard part is, well, what's my idea going to be and how do I make it good?
One of the other things I want to talk to you, Craig, is the fact that we're very fortunate that you do a lot of work in LA, but yet you stay in Memphis. Can you tell me why that is? What is it about Memphis that has you thankfully staying here?
Well, it's what all my friends are now going through with COVID. They're like, I guess I don't have to live here. Usually when people come out, I have an apartment in LA and people come out and they're like, oh, I'm moving here. Oh, I'm moving here. They've got the windows down and the air is coming through and there's that California sunshine. And I was like, okay, well, I'll check back in with you in like the 2 days that you're staying with me for a week. And then after 2 days, they go like, you know, I was in traffic for an hour and a half. And I was just going to like the shoe store that I wanted to go to on the other side of that hill. And I was like, well, what time did you go? Well, just 4 o'clock. I was like, oh God, you can't go at 4 o'clock. Don't you know that like rush hour is going to. So there's all these things in big metropolitan cities that people always go like, oh, it's the big city. I'm going to learn a lot of stuff, but it's also not necessarily conducive to a creative mind. And so I like to be here just because I feel I can be part of a community that I can talk to people at the coffee shop and they're not pitching me a movie. They're talking to me about life. And that means a lot to me, not just on a soulful level, but also it's good fodder for creativity. And now everybody's doing it. Everybody's doing it. Everybody's now rethinking how they do their job. And they're like, are there places in Memphis that I can come to? Because now everything I'm doing is over my laptop. And so everybody's rethinking how they're handling their job right now.
Do you think that there's some upside capacity for Memphis as an artistic community?
Yeah, well, it already is. It's already a huge artistic community. I think that the problem that a lot of people have with equating whether or not we're a creative community is, does it equal kind of like what some could say has happened with me, which is like your deeds are shown on TV or in movies or in print, newspapers doing articles on you. But there's so many people that are doing art right now that don't necessarily require or need mass audiences to see it. They would love it and that'd be great, but it doesn't necessarily fuel them. And that's what I love most about Memphis, is that all of my friends are still the friends that I've had when we were making movies on the streets of Memphis. And we're less thinking about like, well, what's going to be a big hit? And it's just like, well, what's going to be good?
One of the questions also that we just got was, what do you think is the future for movies? I mean, I know this pandemic has changed your industry more probably than anybody's. People aren't going to the movies right now because you can't. So what do you think the future is?
Well, it's very interesting that I was going to have my first major studio release with Coming to America. I mean, it was going to be in 3,000 theaters. It was going to be a global event in theaters. And that's how I try to design my movies, for a communal experience. But now Amazon came along, and because of all the problems with COVID and theaters, and also things that you don't quite think about. So Coming to America, primarily our core audience is our age, because we were young when Coming to America, the first Coming to America. So the core of Coming to America's audience is afraid to go to theaters. And so there was a lot that was a problem with it. Not to mention, and this is some BS a little bit, but there's this notion that African-American based films don't have as big of a foreign revenue or audience. I think that there's a lot to argue with about that, but they primarily, a majority of African-American based films have a huge domestic take. So when Amazon came along and they offered all that money to Paramount, I was disappointed because I love my movies to come out in theaters. But then it got me thinking that, well, on March 5th, millions of people are going to be able to watch it without having to worry about, can I go watch it? And that's probably, unfortunately, but also fortunately, where things are going. I mean, whenever people talk to me about the future of movies, I usually ask them, and this is before COVID, I was like, What did you think of that one particular art film that came out this last week? And they go, oh, well, I haven't seen that. And I go, well, there's your answer. You vote with your dollars. You didn't go. So they're going to stop making those. They're going to make the Marvel movies or the movies that are going to get a big mass audience for it. But now the playing field's oddly kind of level, because now you just watch, you see these event movies as well as smaller movies on your streaming services. So demand has never been higher for content. Everybody wants to be watching some new show. I don't know if any of you are like this, but you're like, what are you watching? I just finished The Flight Attendant. What should I watch now? And that's now the conversation that's happening a lot. So to some extent, whenever like, I have a lot of people call me and say like, my kids want to get into movies and what should I do? And I was like, well, definitely encourage them to do it, because if you're just looking at just employment, like American cinema and television is like, the world wants to be that. There's not other countries that do what we do better in that. And storytelling is never going to go away. It's never, ever, ever going to go away. The conveyor belt as to how people experience these stories may change, but never is there going to be a moment where people are like, I don't need somebody to like toy with my emotions with some great story. I'm just going to go to bed. It's just not going to happen. People need it. And so if anything, there's a lot of opportunity happening right now, but there's just a lot of change that's happening. But I don't think that's bad.
Can you imagine that during this pandemic, if Netflix wasn't there, what would we be doing?
That's what I'm saying. And it's even like, I always look at one of the good reasons to have kids is to learn from them. And so I'll go into my daughter's room and I bought her a big ass TV she could watch, but she's still watching it on an iPad, talking to her friends on a phone. And I'm like, this is not how I watched movies when I was growing up. I'd go down to the Cine 3 and mom would drop me off and I'd sneak in some candy. And like, now they're not even watching shows on like the big screen TV. They want to, I even say like, I've got this big screen TV for you. Do you not want to watch? She goes, I like holding it.
I will say that like, there's an analogy there with music, because when we got away from LPs to CDs and then to streaming, people then realized that like the experience of taking that record out of the container and putting it on the turntable was actually experiential and meaningful. And that's why vinyl has come back strong. And I wouldn't be surprised if movies in the theater eventually come back strong.
Well, I think that that's going to be what theater owners need to wrestle with now. Because, I mean, like so many people, I'm friends with Jimmy Tashi, and he's always said, like, we're selling an experience. We're not selling a product. We're selling something that doesn't even have a, I mean, the movie business is we're basically selling you memories. We're selling you these stories and feelings, and theater owners, they're selling you the experience of that story being told to you. So when I go to Los Angeles and I go to the New Beverly Theater, and that's Quentin Tarantino's theater that he owns. And in Quentin Tarantino's movie theater, you can't have any digital projection. Every single print that he shows has to be on film, which means that you sit down, a guy comes out and he tells you about what movies are showing this week. He tells you about what you're seeing that night. And then suddenly there's an old fashioned newsreel of the date that the movie that you're watching is that night. Then there's a cartoon. Then there's trailers from like 1975. And then you watch a movie and now you've just been put in this experience that's different. And that's kind of the vinyl experience by way of movies. So I think that there's probably going to be a day, unfortunately, where some of these major conglomerates, I mean, I don't think unfortunately, I shouldn't say that, but like, let's say Disney buys a theater chain. So you're going to be dropping off your kids at the Disney movie theater, and on half the building is probably going to have like all these Disney movies that you can see, both old and new. But on the other half of the theater are probably like simulator rides like they have at Disneyland, and then a bunch of restaurants and stores. So it's not just the movie that you're having the experience, but you're having an experience with the world that the movie is in.
I think you should patent that.
I do too. I think it's a great idea.
One could say the same thing about like an Amazon, because Amazon could go like, okay, if they owned a theater, they could look at their data and they could say like, well, in this area, here's the people that are interested in this particular subject matter. And then they can like book it accordingly. It's funny because do you all remember when Mulan came out on Disney? Mulan came out on Disney and you had to pay like, what was it? $30 or something like that to watch it. So there's a lot of people that didn't want to pay that. And there was some people that did and some people who paid it and weren't. And it didn't do as well for Disney as they anticipated. But I was talking to somebody about it And they go, oh, don't think that that was necessarily a bad thing for Disney to do, because Disney then got a lot of data. They knew who was going to pay for it. They knew if people were happy that they paid for it. And then it informed their next movie release off of it. And so it's a constantly evolving business.
Wow, that's great. I'm sad because I'm looking at my clock and I know that we're really running out of time. So I just have a few other questions, but one is very important. And Kim Cherry asked a long time ago, she wants you to tell her a little bit about the picture behind you, which you've already told me about. So the Alamo print behind you.
Alamo or the...
Alamo. We can see that one better.
It's called the Alamo Draft House. It's in Austin, Texas. It's a really cool theater where not only are you watching a movie, but they have waitresses. Every other aisle is gone, and they have a railing there. So it's kind of, imagine if Huey's was a movie theater. So you're watching a movie, and then like these servers come by and put like some food in front of you. I collect foreign movie posters, especially Tennessee Williams themed films. But this is one of my favorite films called I Knew Her Well. And this was Argentina is where this movie poster came from. And then I collect velvet paintings.
I've had the pleasure of seeing them. I wish that you had it so that we could go through and show all those great pictures, because it's wonderful. Well, I'm going to close with one more question, unless you have anything, Jay. I have two questions, because we always ask this question, so I need your opinion. Do you think entrepreneurs are born or taught?
That's a tough one, because I would imagine that it's taught. And what I mean by that, obviously there's people that are like, you could say, are from the moment she was 5 and she sold me a lemonade at an accelerated profit margin. There's those kind of stories, but there's too many stories about people who were like 50 and changed their direction and their life. And so to me, I don't think that's like, well, they were born to be this. They've accumulated an experience that they've learned from. And then they got an idea and they're like, well, I'm going to put some of the things that I've learned in life towards this new venture and I'm going to go forward with it. And so I think that's the ultimate answer, because there's too many people that I know in the business, in my business and every other business, that they were doing one thing and then they decided they were going to do something else. And sometimes that thing was being a mom or stay-at-home person or somebody who wasn't actively out in the business world, but they took what they learned and they created a business off of it. So I would say that life is constantly teaching you, and that's really the ultimate answer over just like you're born with a talent and then you get to fall back on that talent. You can't do that.
In closing, what excites you the most about Memphis right now?
Okay, I'm just going to be honest with my answer on this, because I've been having a lot of conversations about this and I hope everybody's cool with this. I think that we have an opportunity with race. And what I mean by that is someone who I have, without a doubt, benefited from Black culture. My movies, the mentors that I've had in my life, the people that I've worked with, from Lee Daniels, Kenya Barris, to John Singleton, and so forth, I've benefited from African-American culture. And I think that the lesson that I've learned on how to be a white guy who's allowed to work in that world is to be respectful of the culture and to arm people around me with, whether it's their own culture and their own race or not, to be respectful of that and to say like, well, what do we got to do? What do you need to flourish? So I look at our state and I look at what has made us who we are, and we love music. We love barbecue. We love something that we need to basically claim is the soil that's been toiled, that we all benefit from, was toiled through African-American culture. And I like that Memphis is a city that not only has a rich African-American culture, but there's the white culture that goes, no, we love it too. We're in support in and work towards with. I wish we were like that, because so much of what I think Memphis's attitude is whenever somebody says like, oh, Craig, how's Nashville going? I go, excuse me, I'm in Memphis. We're not that. I love going to Nashville. I'm not crapping on Nashville or anything like that, but we are a different city. We are pushed in the corner. We have a different attitude. We have a different mentality. And I think that that is something that is always nervous for a bunch of white people on these squares that I would talk to, like to talk about. But I think that it's something that we have a lot of opportunity in, to further our identity as Memphis, a city that is different than anywhere else in the state and different than anywhere in the country and the world.
Well said.
That is very well said, Craig. And I think I need to say, we're so glad you're here. Thank you for all that you do for Memphis.
Glad you have me.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Craig Brewer. If you want to find more about Craig, you can find a link to the Society of Entrepreneurs profile in our show notes. Thanks for listening to Entrepreneurial Insights. If you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to share with your friends or colleagues. You can find more episodes or subscribe anywhere that you listen to your favorite podcasts. And of course, reviews are always welcome and appreciated. You can also check us out online at entrepreneurialinsightspodcast.com or bluffcitybusiness.com.